ask Brother James to come forward and give us his thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for inviting me. It's very nice to join you this evening. And I'll just share screen. One moment. So hopefully that's okay for everybody. So Isaac and Ishmael, the inspiration for this talk came from a book I read by the former and late chief rabbi, the late Sir Jonathan Sacks, in a book that he wrote called Not in God's Name, in which he looks at this theme of brothers in the book of Genesis. And he traces through the relationships between various brothers, starting with Cain and Abel, and ending up with Joseph and his brothers. And as our readings at the moment are from these chapters in Genesis covering the account of Isaac and Ishmael, I thought it would be good to share these kind of thoughts with you this evening. Now, to set the context, we need to think about how Genesis gives us a narrative both of the origins of human sin, but also, of course, the beginning of God's plan to set things right. And of course, the disobedience of Adam and Eve leads to their separation from God, and the fact that they hid themselves from the presence of the Lord and were then expelled from the Garden of Eden. But it also leads to a separation in their relationship, a separation between Adam and Eve themselves, and the beginning of the blame game, as they blame each other for what had gone wrong. You know, we read in Genesis 3, the man says, "The woman you gave to be with me, she gave me of the fruit of the tree and I ate." So they start to blame each other. Their relationship starts to falter following the first sin. And then much more seriously, of course, in the very next chapter, we have the account of Cain and Abel, the very next steps after the breakdown of the relationship with God. And we read that when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. And I find it so instructive that the very next thing that happens after human beings disobey God is that we have the first murder, the first complete breakdown in human relationships. And I think this pattern in Genesis 4 is just as important, actually, as Genesis 3, the first sin, because it sets the pattern for human conflict, for human violence, for the breakdown of human societies that is a result of all sin, ultimately. And of course, the cycle continues later on in Genesis chapter 4 with the revenge of Lamech. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. So we have this kind of ever-expanding cycle of retribution, of revenge, of violence, of a breakdown in human societies. So I think there's this kind of principle that a separation from God leads to a separation between people. And the prophet Hosea later on gives what I think is a really good summary of this in his own day, which is of relevance later on too. He says of the people of his own day, "There is no faithfulness or steadfast love and no knowledge of God in the land. There is swearing, lying, murder, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bounds and bloodshed follows bloodshed." And so again, I think we have this direct link, no knowledge of God in the land. And instead, there are all these other things, bloodshed following bloodshed. And again, I think it's a sort of a truism of all human societies that where there is no knowledge of God, where there's no acknowledgement of God, then these other things ensue. These other things follow on. There is a breakdown in society because of the breakdown in relationship with God. But of course, the great message of Genesis is that from the time of Cain and Abel, from even before that, from the time of the first sin, God has been at work to put things right. And the argument made by Jonathan Sacks in the book that I mentioned is that we can see this theme by looking particularly at the relationships with of brothers in the book of Genesis, who begin to go against this cycle of violence, who begin to challenge it, really, who break into the cycle of violence that kind of began with Cain and Abel. And these other brothers, Isaac and Ishmael, Jacob and Esau, and eventually, and most sort of the greatest example being Joseph and his brothers, these brothers are divided, but through the hand of God are ultimately reconciled, or at least violence is somehow stayed. Well, in the immediate aftermath of Cain killing Abel, we read of how the cycle of violence and disobedience continues, as we said, the revenge of Lamech, then the flood, and the Tower of Babel. That's in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. But then, of course, God's saving plan really kicks in the end of Genesis 11, and the beginning of Genesis 12, when we're introduced to Abram. And Abram marks the beginning of this new stage of God's purpose of salvation, God's plan to intervene in the ongoing cycle of human wickedness and pride, and to bring this cycle to an end and to turn it around and begin his plan to bless all families of the earth. And so God says to Abraham, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. In you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So this was God's purpose right at the beginning, to bring blessing to all people on the earth, all families of the earth, starting with Abram. And just as disobedience started with one man, with Adam, so this new plan of salvation would begin with the faithfulness of this one man, Abram. And God intended to bring, God intended his blessings to spread into the world through Abram and through Abram's descendants, beginning with Abram's own son. And so this is what God promised in Genesis 15. The word of the Lord came to Abram, your very own son shall be your heir. And so God promises that Abram would have a son. As we know, of course, things didn't work out quite as simply as Abram might at first have thought. 10 years after that promise in Genesis 15, Abram and Sarai didn't have children still. The promise was still not fulfilled. And so they took matters into their own hands. They arranged for Sarai's servant Hagar to be a kind of surrogate wife to bear children to him. This was a really common arrangement in the ancient Middle East at this time. Sons born in this way would still have been legal heirs. Ishmael legally was Abram's firstborn. And actually, you know, in the reading we read in Genesis 21, verse 13, Ishmael is described as Abraham's seed, Abraham's offspring. Legally, Ishmael was the firstborn. But this led to a conflict between Sarai and Hagar. The image there, artist's view of things, shows that after Hagar became pregnant, there arose this jealousy between the two women. Sarai mistreated Hagar, and Hagar fled into the wilderness, where nonetheless God looked after her and told her to return to Abraham. But importantly, God made promises for Ishmael as well, given through Hagar. Now, this is the first of them. The angel of the Lord found Hagar by a spring of water in the wilderness, the spring on the way to Shur. The angel of the Lord said to her, I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude. So it's a promise for Ishmael, really echoing the promise that was first made to Abraham. And the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are pregnant and shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. And the name Ishmael means God hears, or may God hear. So in due course, Hagar gave birth to Abraham's son, Ishmael. So another 13 years passed. And finally, all these years later, God declared that Abram and Sarai would have a son together. And at that point, at the covenant of circumcision in Genesis 17, their names were changed to Abraham and Sarah. So around 23 years after the original promise back in Genesis 15, Abraham and Sarah had their son, Isaac. And as is often pointed out, it's a real lesson in terms of waiting for God's promises. A long period of 23 years had passed until the promise was fulfilled, but nevertheless, it came about. And often we also have to wait for God's promises. And sometimes trying to do things ourselves, our own way, might actually delay things further, as seems to have been the case with Abraham. Now, it's interesting that at this point in Genesis 17, Abraham pleads with God that Ishmael, his son, would be the child of blessing. With that prayer, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." As far as Abraham was concerned at that point, Ishmael was his natural son and natural heir. And so God makes further promises about Ishmael, that he would be a great nation, that he would be the father of 12 princes, but that Isaac is the one who would be the child of promise, the child of the covenant. So as we've read in Genesis 21, Sarah conceived and gave birth to Isaac, a miraculous child, a child of promise born in her old age. And again, this led to conflict with Hagar and Ishmael. Hagar went away from Abraham and Sarah with her son Ishmael, this time permanently. This is also shown by the picture here, but unfortunately the ages of the children are wrong as far as the biblical account is concerned. Ishmael would have been about 13 or 14 at this time, whereas in the picture he looks not much older than Isaac. But Ishmael would have been a young teenager at the point Isaac was born. But nevertheless, once again, God was with them in the wilderness and again promised to make Ishmael into a great nation. So again, these promises keep being repeated. Well, that's the kind of basic outline of events that we know well, really. But let's just take a step back and think about what we can learn about God's purpose of salvation. As we've seen, Genesis 1 to 11 is all about this cycle of violence, the cycle of revenge multiplying on the earth, starting off with Cain and Abel, the first murder, then the revenge of Lamech spiraling out of control, the flood, the wickedness that multiplied on the earth, the Tower of Babel. God's call of Abraham was supposed to bring that cycle to an end with these promises to bless all nations through Abraham. But it's not long before we end up with, again, the story of two brothers, jealousy, family rivalries, bitterness, hatred between them. The story of Isaac and Ishmael perhaps threatens to follow the same pattern as before, with the older son rejected as Cain's offering had not been accepted by God, the older son being rejected. Maybe Ishmael, the older brother, would have felt like he wanted to kill his younger brother, Isaac, this favored younger sibling. And we certainly see the beginnings of sibling rivalry in Genesis 21, the chapter we read, where Ishmael seems to be mocking Isaac, though, of course, he was still a teenager at that point. But the beginnings of that jealousy, the beginnings of that rivalry, beginning to make themselves evident. But this ongoing strife between brothers was not what God wanted. It was not God's purpose for human beings to be at enmity with one another. And I think there are really two key ways in which we see God intervening in this family, the family of Abraham, to make sure this cycle of brother against brother doesn't repeat. And he does it in two ways. Firstly, by subverting all expectations and by choosing Isaac instead of Ishmael, choosing the younger instead of the older. And secondly, though, by caring for and blessing Ishmael anyway, by still promising blessings to Ishmael so that this cycle of revenge doesn't continue. So let's think about each of these two points in turn. First, the choice of the younger. Second, God's blessings for Ishmael. So God choosing Isaac. We're so used to thinking about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It trips off the tongue. We pray to the great God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we don't think how unnatural that is. In most human societies, it should have been Abraham, Ishmael, and Nebaioth who are the line of descent. That they were the firstborn. Abraham, Ishmael was his firstborn. Nebaioth was his firstborn. We don't think about them, but that would have been the natural order of things. In this time, in this culture, natural and in most human societies, the natural order is for the firstborn son to be the one through whom the family line is traced, who would be the one who inherits from the father. So we would expect that Ishmael should be Abraham's heir. He was the firstborn son. Even though it was through a surrogate mother, he would have still legally been the firstborn, legally been the heir. He was strong and independent. He's described as being a wild donkey of a man in Genesis 16, living in the wilderness, becoming an expert with a bow, as we read in Genesis 21. At one point, as we've seen, he was actually favored by his father in Genesis 17 when Abraham pleads that Ishmael might live before God. But instead, God chooses Isaac, the younger son. Just as earlier he'd favored the sacrifice of Abel, the younger son, and as later on he would choose to bless Jacob rather than Esau and Joseph rather than his older brothers, God's choice is not the natural choice, the human choice. And why is this? Well, of course, it was Isaac, not Ishmael, who was the son of promise, the son that God had promised to Abraham. Ishmael was born through Abraham and Sarah's own contrivance, through their own plans, but Isaac was a miraculous child, a child born by Sarah in her old age. And Paul writes about the difference between Isaac and Ishmael in an allegorical sense in Galatians. Abraham had two sons, one by a slave woman, one by a free woman, but the son of the slave was born according to the flesh, while the son of the free woman was born through promise. So it was Isaac who was the son of promise, the son given by the grace of God, by God's favor to Abraham, not through his own efforts. And I think the principle behind this is that God wants us to rely not on our own efforts and our own plans, but or our own strength, but instead he wants us to rely on his promise and his goodness. This is what Moses warned the people of Israel later on when they were about to enter the promised land. Beware lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. You shall remember that the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth. So the same thing applied to Abraham. Abraham could look at Ishmael and say, this is my son who was born through my own plans. But Isaac was born only because of God's promise and God's grace. And that's why God chose Isaac to be the one through whom his plan of salvation would be worked out, both in his generation, but in the centuries ever since as well. So this is the first intervention by God in the family of Abraham. God chooses Isaac, the younger son, rather than the older son, Ishmael, against the natural order of things. The second way is that God still cares for Ishmael. Given God's choice of Isaac, we would expect Ishmael to seek some kind of revenge, just like Cain, that earlier elder brother, took revenge on his younger brother Abel. Or we'd expect that Ishmael would at least be despised in some way. But instead, we find throughout the story of Isaac and Ishmael that God cares for Ishmael and for his mother Hagar. When the pregnant Hagar was first turned away from Abraham's household, God came and spoke to her in the desert at the well named Beer Lehi Roy. Actually, the name comes from Hagar herself, her words, you are a God of seeing, because Beer Lehi Roy means the well of the living one who sees me. This is what Hagar recognized, that God had seen her in her distress. And so she followed what God said to return to Abraham's household. And then the second time when Hagar left Abraham with her son after Isaac, the younger son, was born, again, God came to her, as we've read in Genesis 21. And we read that God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven, fear not, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Up, lift up the boy and hold him fast with your hand, for I will make him into a great nation. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink, and God was with the boy, and he grew up. And so we see here God's loving care for Hagar and for Ishmael in the desert, providing water for them to drink, being with the boy as he grew. And so although it's Isaac who's the one who is is the chosen one, who is the child of the covenant, the child of promise, it doesn't therefore mean that Ishmael is neglected. God still takes care of Hagar and Ishmael. And also notice here this promise of blessing that God will make him into a great nation. And in fact, several times, as we've seen in the account of Isaac and Ishmael, God promises blessings for Ishmael. First, in Genesis 16, to Hagar, I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered. Then to Abraham at the time of the covenant of circumcision in Genesis 17, as for Ishmael, I will make him fruitful, multiply him greatly. He shall father 12 princes, and I will make him into a great nation. And then, as we've just seen, to Hagar and Ishmael when they were sent away from Abraham and Sarah. And these blessings were fulfilled. They became a reality for Ishmael. He had 12 sons who became heads of tribes. And of course, there's a very interesting parallel between that and the 12 grandsons of Isaac, who became the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. So Ishmael had his own family, his own descendants. The sons of Ishmael are named in Genesis 25, and his life is summarized like this. These are the sons of Ishmael. These are their names. Those are in the verses before, which I didn't put, so I didn't have to read them out. By their villages, by their encampments, 12 princes according to their tribes. These are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. He breathed his last and died, and was gathered to his people. They settled from Havilah to Shur, which is opposite Egypt, in the direction of Assyria. He settled over against all his kinsmen. So Ishmael's descendants grew in number, and he became effectively the forefather of the Arab peoples. And so this is the important point, that Isaac was chosen, but it didn't mean necessarily that Ishmael was rejected. God's blessings were inclusive, not exclusive. Choosing one son to be the child of promise, the one through whom the covenant was made, the one through whom God's plan of salvation was made, didn't mean that the other one was excluded from blessings, because actually God's blessings are enough for everyone. That was his purpose all along. All families of the earth would be blessed through Abraham. Rather, I think God chooses individuals in order to bring blessings to others. That's why he chose Abraham in the first place. He chose Isaac not only for Isaac's own sake, but also that his plan of salvation might be worked through Isaac to bring blessings to more and more people. What did this mean for Isaac and Ishmael? At the very least, it meant that there was no cycle, no kind of perpetuation of that cycle of violence and revenge and retribution that we saw in the early chapters of Genesis. There's none of that with Isaac and Ishmael. They might not have lived together, but they weren't in conflict. That's the first point to make. It might be a negative one, but they were not killing each other as Cain and Abel had been. We've read in Genesis 21 that Ishmael went away and lived in the wilderness separately from his brother Isaac. Hagar took a wife for Ishmael from the Egyptians, and of course she was herself Egyptian, so that kind of makes sense. Now we read that Ishmael continued to live in the wilderness over against all his kinsmen. That's a phrase that comes in Genesis, both in Genesis 16 and again in Genesis 25. But this phrase doesn't describe open warfare. Rather, it describes friction caused by Ishmael's fiercely independent, apparently nomadic lifestyle, in contrast to the more settled life of Isaac and his descendants. It could imply some kind of hostility, but really it just means opposite or across from or at the edge of society or at the margins of society. He was living in the desert. He was living away from the more settled life of Isaac and his descendants. So at the very least, we can say that Isaac and Ishmael went their separate ways, but there was no further conflict between them. Can we say any more than that? Well, there's a couple of little hints, perhaps, of further reconciliation between the two brothers, or at least an understanding between them. After the death of Sarah, we find that Isaac went on a visit to Beer Lehi Roy, here in Genesis 24. Now, Isaac had returned from Beer Lehi Roy and was dwelling in the Negev. That's just at the moment when Abraham's servant comes back with Rebekah as Isaac's wife. So he's been on this visit to Beer Lehi Roy. It doesn't say what he's been doing there. But remember, that's the place that was named by Hagar, the well of the living one who sees me. So had Isaac been on some kind of reconciliation mission to his brother Ishmael after the death of his mother Sarah, who ultimately was her jealousy with Hagar was the thing that had caused Hagar and Ishmael to leave in the first place. Perhaps Isaac wanted to establish better terms with his brother after his mother's death. And at any rate, we know for certain that the two brothers came together after the death of Abraham to bury their father. And we read in the next chapter, Genesis 25, Isaac and Ishmael, his sons, buried Abraham in the cave of Machpelah. The picture actually doesn't show Isaac and Ishmael, but it sort of illustrates the point that they came together to bury their father. And then later, finally, after the death of Abraham, Isaac actually settled at Beer Lehi Roy in Genesis 25, verse 11. So in the same vicinity of Ishmael. So at the very least, they were able to live side by side, brothers not in conflict. And they came together at the death of their father, were able to bury their father together. We don't know the full extent of their reconciliation, but at the very least, that cycle of retribution that began with Cain and Abel had been stopped in the relationship between Isaac and Ishmael. So in the life of Isaac and Ishmael, God intervened to change events in two ways. We would have expected Ishmael to be Abraham's heir. That's what Abraham himself actually pleaded for in Genesis 17. But instead, we see the working out of this principle that we find throughout the Bible, that God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. God chooses what is weak to show that we should not rely on ourselves, but on him. And secondly, we would have expected Ishmael to seek some kind of revenge, but instead God shows blessings and care for Ishmael as well, because as Psalm 145 says, the Lord is good to all. Or as he's promised Abraham in Genesis 12, in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. God's love isn't zero sum. Brothers don't have to compete for God's favor. For those who trust in him, God's love is enough for everyone. And although we only get perhaps little hints or glimpses of possible reconciliation between Isaac and Ishmael, we certainly get much fuller accounts of reconciliation later on in Genesis. In Genesis 32, we have a whole chapter dealing with Jacob's plans to be reconciled to Esau. You know, Esau at one time had wanted to kill him, so no wonder he was afraid when he was returning from Laban. And there's that whole chapter about how he sends out messengers in advance and he divides his family into two camps and the animals as well, and he sends on a present ahead of him. All those detailed preparations. Why do we get all that detail in Genesis? I think there's a reason for it, because it's emphasizing this progress towards this reconciliation. But actually, when it comes to it, in the end, Esau is only too ready to welcome his brother. Esau says, I have enough, my brother. And Jacob says, no, please, if I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand, for I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. Please accept my blessing. Actually, this phrase at the end there, and please accept my blessing. That's so interesting because remember, Jacob had gone to all that trouble to steal the blessing and the birthright in the first place. But now here he is, a changed man, insisting that his brother accepts the blessing back from him, or a blessing back from him. And in fact, I think they're both changed men in this way. They're through the work of God, through the hand of God, that they are reconciled as brothers. Esau once wanting to kill Jacob, Jacob having to flee for his life, but they welcome and accept one another as brothers. And in a similar vein, we have in Genesis 45, one of the most moving accounts in the Bible of reconciliation, when Joseph greets his brothers, "I am your brother. I'm your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." And he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. After that, his brothers talked with him. So there's a profound message in these accounts about recognizing the strangers, as Joseph does, to actually be his brothers and to be reconciled with them. And Joseph recognizes too the greatness of God's plan, that through this process that he'd gone through and ultimately this process of reconciliation, God has been at work all along, preserving life, preserving his people, and indeed being through them a blessing to all nations of the earth, because it's not only them but all nations that come to get bread from Egypt at the time of the famine. So God has this great plan, which is first to preserve his own people, but also extending out from that to bring blessings to all nations. But I want to just conclude on a down-to-earth and practical note, if I can. Abraham was chosen to be a blessing to others. And Abraham, of course, has this unique role in God's purpose. Might seem way beyond our own reach. But what does it mean in practice? It seems like a high ideal for us to attain to. But in fact, Abraham is commended himself for some apparently quite small things, small acts of kindness. For example, showing hospitality to three strangers who arrived at his tent in the heat of the day. And of course, they turned out to be angels, as Hebrews reminds us. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. So this is what being a blessing means to other people in practice. Not necessarily huge and world-changing acts, but small things that we can do every day. Starting small, being a blessing to other people in small, practical, day-to-day ways. That's what we're called to do in our lives, I think, as we share in Abraham's faith today. And then one final example. When Abraham's servant was looking for a wife for Isaac, he prayed that the one who showed kindness to him would be the one that God had chosen. And the way that she would do this, the way that she would show kindness, was by giving a drink not only to him as a stranger, but even also to his camels. And so we meet Rebecca. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, "Please give me a little water to drink from your jar." She said, "Drink, my lord." And she quickly let down her jar upon her hand and gave him a drink. When she had finished giving him a drink, she said, "I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking." So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran again to the well to draw water, and she drew for all his camels. Now that might seem like a small act, a trivial act, slightly humorous from our point of view now, but that's what marked out Rebecca to be the wife of Isaac and the grandmother of the 12 sons of Jacob. That one act of kindness showed her real character. And so again, that's what it means to be a blessing to other people. That's the thing that breaks the cycle of violence and vengeance even today. Not necessarily great acts, but small acts of kindness, of forgiveness, of reconciliation. And so that's the final message, really, that we should all be giving drinks to camels or helping anyone who needs our help, showing love and kindness in small ways as we have the opportunity to do it. And so in small ways, we can show our faith in the Lord Jesus and the hope that one day the blessings promised to Abraham will be realized for the whole world, that all families of the earth will be blessed and the whole world will be fully reconciled to God through our Lord Jesus. So thank you.